Last week in chapters, I think we were in chapters 2 and 3 for the most part last week, and we'll just kind of bring you back up to date. Of course, Job is suffering the loss of his fortune and his family as far as his children go, his 10 children. His wife is still around, and then that wasn't enough to turn him from his faithfulness in the Lord. And so Satan urges God to afflict him, afflict his flesh, and so God allows Satan to do such, but puts the condition on Satan that he spare Job's life. So the affliction is not such that it's going to be life-threatening, but Job is then afflicted with boils from the top of his head to even the soles of his feet. And after being afflicted with boils, which is, of course, a very painful condition, Job does not curse God, but rather the response is that he wishes that he could die. That he wishes that he had never been born. The urging from his wife, on the other hand, was that he shouldn't. One of my favorite verses in the Bible, his wife urges him to curse God and die. And he does not take that advice from his wife. But rather, you can see the darkness and really almost the depression that he goes into after the loss of virtually everything that in this world that he knows. And he curses the day that he was born and wishes that he had never been born and wishes that that day never existed. And so that's where we stand, that he longs for the rest of death. And really, in some instances, you can identify with that. Some people get to the point in their lives through sickness or, you know, through in medical conditions or unfortunate circumstances, they just want to die. You know, the elderly get to a point where they're not functional and they just want to get to they just want to end what is in this world. And that's where he's at. He is just longing for death. Longing for death. Meanwhile, he's got three friends that show up to mourn with him the loss of everything. And for an entire week, they sit with him silent and don't offer any condolence, don't offer any advice, but rather just sit there and grieve and mourn with him. And let him basically say what he's going to say, which brings us then to where we are in chapter 4 this evening. And what's going to happen is we're going to see the first friend speak. Now, we're not going to be able to, because of the length of what he has to say, we're not going to be able to get through everything that he says. We're going to have to finish that up next week. But he is going to speak, and then next week we'll finish what he has to say, and we'll see Job's response to the first friend's response to Job's calamity. So, Eliphaz is the first friend that is there that offers his opinion of the situation. Now, bear in mind, Job was the richest man in the world and was very blessed with possessions, very blessed with offspring, had 10 children, very blessed in every way. And God had built what the Bible says, a hedge around him, protected him from evil, protected him from anything that would befall him. And all that was removed, and in less than a day, everything that Job had built, worked for, and possessed was taken away. And so Eliphaz then is obviously upset along with Job that all this has befallen Job, and it's obviously an evil that's come upon Job. And you see then in chapter 4, verse 1, then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "If we assuage to commune with thee," so if we continue to sit here with thee, "wilt thou be grieved? But who can withhold himself from speaking?" So they've already sat there for an entire week without saying a thing. And so it's come time that we have to say something about the situation. Now, Eliphaz and everyone else believed Job to be a good man. But you see the situation. And everybody's going to make a judgment, aren't they? And we do the same thing. You know, if someone especially is very rich and something happens to them, and they lose all that wealth, immediately they say, "Well, they must have deserved it. You know, they must have done something." I can remember years ago, of course Donald Trump is wealthy again, but there was a time when Donald Trump even fell on very hard times and just about lost all his wealth. You know, and there's a lot of people who deserted him that were once his, I suppose, friends. Almost everybody deserted him. There were very few that were loyal to him that once surrounded him. And everybody took off because he had just about lost everything. But, you know, those on the outside looking in, well, you know, here's a guy that, you know, swindles people, robs people, does anything for a buck, you know, and you make all of these judgments about someone like that. You know, Whitney Houston died recently, sitting in a bathtub. Well, first thing you do is you make judgments about her. And here's a lady with drug problems and hung out with all the wrong people and did all the wrong things and, you know, lived a fast life and with wild people, you know, so you make judgments immediately about why she died. Well, some of the judgments were probably right. You know, they found out she drowned. You know, what caused her to drown? Well, there's things in her system that probably knocked her out. She probably didn't even know she was going under the water. But, you know, did she deserve to die? No, she didn't deserve to die. Do people deserve evil that comes on them? No, they don't deserve those things. But here we're going to find that everybody judges. And, you know, when you're up at the very highest point, of course the bottom is a lot farther away, isn't it? You got a lot farther to fall. And everybody is going to put their two cents in and have an opinion of why that happened. And here we have a friend, and he's going to add his two cents in as to why all these calamities have happened to Job. While he appears to be a good man, appearances can be deceiving. And that's going to really be much of the conclusion of Eliphaz. He says, "Behold, thou hast instructed many, and thou hast strengthened the weak hands. Thy words have upholden him that was fallen, and thou hast strengthened the feeble knees." In other words, you've helped a lot of people. You've done a lot of good for a lot of people that needed help. It's just no different than, you know, a rich man who's given to charities and done, you know, charity work and done things for those who needed help and, you know, supposedly, you know, on the surface, very good and very upright and very good standing in social social circles, and here Job is supposed to be a righteous man, and apparently so. But you see the next word in verse 5, but appearances can be deceiving. But now it has come upon thee. All the things that had happened to these other people that you had to help. They were never as rich as you. They never had as much as you. And you had to help them. And you gave them advice about the troubles in their life and the things that they were doing wrong and why they were miserable and all these things. Now, all the things that you were advising them about, the same troubles have come upon you. It's no different. I had to laugh when I read this. Because it's kind of personal. It's very kind of personal. As someone who stands up here on Sunday morning, and I preach to the congregation. This is how the Christian should live. And if you don't, then these consequences can happen. Well, sometimes, as it turns out, consequences can happen even though you do all the right things. Sometimes bad things happen even though you're a very good person. And here we're having Eliphaz going to judge Job, and we're going to see what kind of judgment he gives. He says, but now these same problems, it has come upon thee, and thou faintest, it toucheth thee, and thou art troubled. So all the things that you counsel people on and say, well, pick up your bootstraps. Get up off the ground and go back to work and do your best and get off welfare and go find a job and all these things. Well, now it's come upon you and you're sitting here crying and moaning and wishing you were dead. It's a whole different story when it's you, isn't it? And you know what? The Bible's right. Eliphaz is right. Eliphaz is right. I went to see a man today because of my work. I went to see a man today, and as it turned out, I don't talk politics any more than I have to, but some people it just spurts out of their mouth. As soon as you show up and they start talking about the world, politics comes out of their mouth, and he started talking about, people on welfare, and they're sucking up tax dollars, and this, that, and the other thing. And boy, he was just beating on people that were, because he works in a hospital. And he was talking about one lady that shows up and demands services. She's a diabetic. And she demands treatment. And she demands this and that until she gets better. And then she just rips all the stuff out of her and she leaves and goes and drinks pop and all the bad things for her until she makes herself sick again. Then she comes back in and into the ICU again. $30,000 worth of treatment later, she rips all the stuff out and goes and does the same stuff again. And boy, he was just going on and on and on. And I can understand that because she doesn't pay for any of this stuff. She doesn't pay for any of this stuff. But, the whole time I'd already done the Job study, and in the back of my mind I'm thinking, well, here I am standing and this guy has a nice farm, and he's a nurse, as it turns out. And he's a nurse at a hospital, and his wife has a nice job, and this is a beautiful place. There's 7 acres out here in the middle of the country and everything. And I'm thinking, well, what if this ever happened to you? What if you were the one who was destitute? I mean, this lady obviously has mental problems of some sort, or else she'd want treatment. But he doesn't see it that way. He just sees, the problems and all the people sucking off the system. What if it ever happened to you that you were the one living under a bridge? That you lost everything? If the shoe was on the other foot, how would you respond? How would it affect your mind? Maybe that lady at one time had millions of dollars and lost it all. Maybe her mind's never been the same ever since. I don't know. I don't know her whole story. I've never met her. I don't know. Maybe she's a Job in disguise. I have no idea. But Job's apparent righteousness according to Eliphaz, should have prevented all this evil from coming upon him. The fact that he, if he was truly righteous, if he was truly a good person, that in and of itself should have prevented evil from affecting him. And you see that in verse 6. He says, "Is this not thy fear, thy confidence, thy hope in the uprightness of thy ways?" And that's what that means. In other words, all these things that have happened to you should never have happened. If in fact you are who you appear to be, if you are in fact as righteous and as good and as sinless and perfect as we all think that you are, or that you have appeared to be. So what Eliphaz does is he accuses Job. He accuses Job. And Eliphaz has a theory about sin. And his theory is about sin, as it turns out, is probably as good as any other Christian's theory about sin. You know, people have theories, why does a hurricane hit a particular part of the country? You know, why did Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans? Well, because New Orleans has Mardi Gras, I suppose. Yeah. You know, and all the debauchery that happens during Mardi Gras. Why did the planes run into the Twin Towers? Well, because the Twin Towers are the center of evil commerce of the world. You know, everybody has a theory about sin, don't they? And why things happen? Why does God do the things that He does? Well, Eliphaz has a theory too, and he develops that theory. Verses 7 through 11. So we'll just read those together. He says, Eliphaz says to Job, "Remember, I pray thee, who ever perished being innocent?" So right there is an accusation. Who ever lost anything if they're innocent? If they've never done anything, who ever perished? Who ever lost anything? Nobody ever was accused. You know, nothing ever happens to someone if they don't have something to lose, in other words. Or where were the righteous cut off? So in other words, the you read between the lines, what he's saying is you're not innocent and you're unrighteous. There's the reading between the lines. So, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the righteous cut off? Even as I have seen, so I have personally seen this. This is my experience. That they plow iniquity and sow wickedness, they that plow iniquity and sow wickedness reap the same. Ooh, stab me in the back. Yeah, stab me in the back. He's calling Job iniquitous and wicked. And you're reaping what you've sown. You are reaping what you've sown, my friend. And by the blast of God they perish. So Eliphaz is saying it is God that is doing this to you. So he's pointing toward God. Now, is it God that's doing this to Job? We need to know. Is this God that's doing this to you? It is. Indirectly, it is. God is letting Satan do this to Job. God has given Satan permission to do this to Job. So Eliphaz is correct in one respect here. And he says, by the blast of God, the wicked and the iniquitous, the people who are not innocent and the unrighteous, they perish. And by the breath of his nostrils, they are consumed. I mean, this is my experience. This is what I have seen throughout my life. That all these bad people, God just takes care of them right now. The roaring of the lion and the voice of the fierce lion and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The old lion perisheth for lack of prey, and the stout lion's whelps are scattered abroad. So all those nasty, evil people that walk the world, they're going to get theirs. God's going to make sure that they pay for all the evil, unrighteous, nasty things that they do while they're still here in the world. Just like back there in Noah's day where he flooded the world and killed them all. He does that on a daily basis. He looks for evil people and sends lightning bolts out at them. That's what Eliphaz's theory of sin is. Now, a lot of people believe that to be true. Most people, I bet you most people, if you were to go to church after church after church after church and just do a survey of Christians, people who sit in church pews, and ask them, does God punish sinners while they're on the earth alive? Not Christians, but unbelievers. You know, you got to be more specific. You know, Joe Barstool, that's sitting on Sunday morning getting drunk at Joe's Bar and Grill, does God see him and send lightning bolts after him to try to ruin his life? To make him, to torture him? And I'll bet most Christians would say, yes, God does. If for no other reason to straighten him out. Get him back on the straight and narrow. To get him into church. To change his evil ways. To prove to him that living this life of drunkenness and wantonness is not productive. But is that what the Bible says? Is that what the Lord says? Is that what God says? That's what Eliphaz says. And that's what he's telling Job. That you're not innocent, you're unrighteous, you're iniquitous, you're wicked. And God's punishing you because of all these things. Well, and I don't mean to be cruel because your granddaughter's son just died. But that is the implication. That's the implication there. The plane just crashed. And the implication would be that there was some kind of secret sin in his life and God made that plane crash because he was a wicked man. But, I know. I think about myself too. You know, if that was true, God would have run my truck off the road on the way here. But, I mean, how far can you possibly take that whole theory of sin, Eliphaz's theory of sin? Is that what God really does? And the answer is in the Bible. You look at James chapter 5. I can go numerous places, as a matter of fact, and we're going to. Because this question has to be answered. Is Eliphaz right in his theory of sin? James 5:5, we just studied James, and we covered this. James 5:5 and 6. James talking to the evil, James talking to the wicked and the iniquitous, the unrighteous and those who are not innocent, says, you have lived in pleasure on the earth and have been wanton. Ye have nourished your hearts as in a day of slaughter. Ye have condemned and killed the just. And he, God, doth not resist you. God doesn't resist the evil. God doesn't resist those who are out there doing iniquity. Now, you might find that hard to believe, that God would not try to keep the evil people from doing all the evil things. You know, there might be a gunman standing right out the front door of this church, ready to gun us all down as we leave this evening. We don't know. And you might say to yourself, well, God will protect us, and supernaturally, somebody will drive by and run him over before we walk out that door, because we're good Christians. But the fact of the matter is, no. God does not resist the evil. Evil is in the world. The days, as Paul says, are what, Mike? Evil. Evil. Have they always been evil? Ever since sin was in the world. Ever since sin came into the world, the days have been evil. Events happen the same to good and evil. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 2. All things come alike to all. Now, this just kind of blows out of the water the theory of why did Katrina hit New Orleans? Why does one person die and another person doesn't? The tornado hits this house, but not that house. That house must have been full of a bunch of sinners that had orgies every weekend or something. No. It's because all things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked. In other words, that tornado is not going to discriminate and say, oh, a Christian lives there. Whoop, going to hop over that house. It's going to blow that house down too. There's one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth and to him that sacrificeth not. As is to the good, so is to the sinner, and he that sweareth as he that feareth an oath. The hurricane will blow your house down just as quick as it will the pagan that lives next door. Good and evil have existed in the world together. And the Lord explained why while He was walking around here on earth during His ministry in Matthew chapter 13, verse 24. In a parable, He explained about the tares and the wheat. The good people being the wheat, the bad people being the tares. Starting in Matthew 13, verse 24, another parable put He forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which sowed good seed in his field. All right. So you guys are the good seed out there in the field. Wonderful. Now, we all know that if you put good seed out in the field, you want to keep the weeds out, don't you? Because the good seed will grow up into good, strong plants. And all the weeds do, they come in and they creep in, they take all the nourishment and the water and keep the good plants from growing up strong and healthy and producing good fruit. Isn't that true? He's had a garden before. She's nodding her head. She knows all about that. That's why the farmers, they spray all that Roundup on their fields to keep the vines and weeds from growing in the cornfields. Get good yields. But unfortunately, while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares, that's like weeds, among the wheat, and went his way. And when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So in other words, it's too late to spray Roundup once the corn's up, because you're going to kill the corn along with the weeds. So you can't spray the herbicide on top of the corn, because it's going to kill the corn too. It's just a fact of farming. So what do you do? Well, verse 27, so the servants of the householder came and said unto him, sir, didst thou not sow, good seed in thy field? From whence then hath it tares? Why are there weeds growing in our field of corn? He said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then that we go and gather them up? Well, the problem with doing that is that the tares, the roots of the tares intertwine with the roots of the good plant. And when you pull up the weeds, it also pulls up the roots of the good plants. So what's the best thing to do? You just leave them go. You just let it alone. At that point, there's nothing to do but just let it go. So verse 29, he says, nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root up also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest, and in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. So it won't be until the Lord returns that the wheat and the tares will be separated. Until then, evil and good have to coexist and intermingle here in the world. Meanwhile, your Apostle Paul says that God is not deceived. Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 9. That we do reap what we sow, but it's going to be in due season. Notice, be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. He that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. It's in due season. Due season is when? When the wheat and the tares are harvested and they're separated, the tares are burned, the wheat is put in the barn. That's the due season. Meanwhile, the wheat and the tares are going to coexist, and they're going to grow together. And James says, God is not going to resist the growing of the tares. He's not going to try to pull them out of the ground, and they are going to thrive as weeds do. They're going to thrive as weeds do. So Eliphaz's theory of sin would seem to be wrong. That God does not make the old lion perish for lack of prey. God does not blast those with the breath of his nostrils to be consumed, those who are unrighteous and whatever. But Eliphaz does, in fact, have a vision. He has a vision. And that's starting in Job chapter 4, verse 12. Now, a thing was secretly brought to me, Eliphaz says, and mine ear received a little thereof. In thoughts from the visions of the night, when deep sleep falleth on men, fear came upon me in trembling, which made all my bones to shake. Then a spirit passed before my face, the hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern the form thereof. An image was before mine eyes. There was silence, and I heard a voice saying, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his Maker? What's that all about? Well, if you read a lot of commentaries on Job, there's a lot of disagreement about who the Spirit is, and it really doesn't matter. But it was a spirit from God. It was probably an angel from God, or a vision from God. It was not a devilish vision of any kind. It was a godly vision. Because what is it teaching? It's teaching that man is not more godly than God himself. It is teaching that God is not more righteous than God himself. The Creator is more just than the created. The creature cannot be more perfect than the Creator. You see, it is God that is the justifier. Paul says in Romans 8:33, it is God that justifieth. That, amongst many verses that show is God in Christ that are the just and the justifier. Man is never the justifier of anything. Man is never the just. We are always the guilty. And in need of justification, God is always the just and the justifier of those who believe. So that is the problem with Eliphaz's theory of sin. Remember, Eliphaz had this theory that Job's sin caused the problems that he was having. And my contention personally is that many people believe that. That there's going to be secret sin in your life, and that secret sin is going to cause problems. God is going to punish you for that secret sin, especially if you're not a Christian. God is going to punish people for their secret sin. And that works even to those who are not Christians. Next week we're going to find out that God does in fact play an active role in man's life, but to a different purpose and to a different extent. God is not the blast of a breath to consume men. God is not taking the prey out of the lion's mouth, but rather plays quite a different role in the life of men. And so here Eliphaz is seeing a vision, and the lesson is, shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his maker? And frankly, that's exactly what Eliphaz is expecting of Job. That's exactly what Eliphaz is expecting of Job. Who was it? Jimmy Swagger. Remember him, don't you? We all remember Jimmy Swagger, don't we? He was the one that got caught in the motel room with the prostitute. Two prostitutes, was it? Or two times, okay. I'll bet it was more times than that. He just got caught twice. I'll bet it was a lot more times than that. He just got caught twice. He was a TV preacher. Yeah, I remember watching him all the time. I used to love watching him. And I know he's on TV now, but I used to love to watch him. He was fiery. He was just dynamic. I don't know of any other word. He was dynamic. And I mean, he could deliver a message like no one else's business. He could make you believe that black was white, and it's just unbelievable. And here the man was living a completely different life. Now, I don't know that his entire life away from the camera was nothing but debauchery, but at some point there was a moral breakdown. At some point, there was a moral breakdown in his life. There's no other way to describe it. I mean, at some point, there was a moral breakdown. There was a moral slip-up. And he got caught. And everybody judged him for that. But you know what? And nobody forgave him, did they? The Assembly of God Church excommunicated him. There's no forgiveness there. No. But the question, there's no question, but the lesson being taught to Eliphaz, who is not giving forgiveness to Job, but rather ready to excommunicate him from friendship, basically. accusing him of being unrighteous, of being wicked, iniquitous. Because all these things are happening. What this vision is from God is telling him is that men are imperfect. Men are not God. Men are sinful no matter who they are. They can have vast wealth, do great things, do charitable deeds from sunup to sundown, help infinite numbers of people, and have a hedge around them of protection from God, and do all these things, and still they are sinful man. Shall mortal man be more just than God? Shall a man be more pure than his Maker? And the answer is one word, no. No. Not Job, not Jimmy Stewart, or Jimmy Swagger. Not Jimmy Stewart either. None of us. None of us. None of us. And to drive home the point, part of the vision was, part of the message was, verse 18, behold, he, God, put no trust in his servants, and his angels he charged with folly. Well, you have to understand the context. His servants were the spiritual beings that were created by God. In other words, the spiritual beings, the angels. Look at 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4. You find the angels that are held in chains of darkness until the time of judgment because they sin. In Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 15, iniquity was found in Lucifer. He was created perfect until the day that iniquity was found in him. They were given free will to choose, were they going to follow the ways of God, or were they going to reject the ways of God? Excuse me. But meanwhile, that's the meaning of that. Even the spiritual beings, the created servants, the created spiritual beings and his angels, they did things of folly too, sinful, silly things. But even more certain than those beings is the sinfulness of man. Of course, Romans 5:12, that we've all Romans 5:12 that there are none righteous, no, not one. And we find out that wherefore is by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, so that death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. So, all having sinned, sin is a certainty amongst men. And Eliphaz, in his vision, then says, how much less in them, how much less the trust that God puts in them, which is us, that dwell in houses of clay. That's who we are, whose foundation is in the dust, which are crushed before the moth. In other words, we die. We die. They're destroyed from morning to evening. They perish forever without any regarding it. Doth not their excellency, the excellency of men, in other words, this creation of God, which is in them, go away. They die even without wisdom. People die every day, don't they? I don't know how many people die in the world every day, and yet we don't even regard it, do we? Don't even pay attention to it. Everything they were, everything they knew, is gone. And yet it doesn't bother us a bit. Life goes on. So Eliphaz in chapter 5, verse 1, calls for an answer from Job and says, basically, which of the saints can you compare your condition to? Which of the believers in God is it that you can say has had it as bad as you? Or even can you compare your current condition to? Which of the saints has ever been chastised by God before in such a way as you are now experiencing? And it says in verse 1, call now, if there be any that will answer me, and to which of the saints wilt thou turn? That's exactly, he's not praying to the saints. That's exactly what that means, is what? Which one of the believers, which one of the saints in the past can you point to that has ever suffered the way that you're suffering now? What righteous man has ever lost everything the way that you've lost everything? Who has lost as much as you? He says, for wrath killed the foolish man, and envy slayed the silly one. And then he counts his personal experience again. He says, I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate. Neither is there any to deliver them, whose harvest the hungry eateth up, and taketh it even out of the thorns, and the robbers swalloweth up their substance. So once again, here's Eliphaz and his theory of sin. I've seen the foolish. They take root, but I cursed them. And God curses them too and makes them disappear. See this? How he's beaten up Job with this? I mean, he's absolutely pounding on Job. Even though there's no apparent unrighteousness in Job's life, well, Eliphaz has no doubt that it's secret sin, this hidden sin, that's the cause of Job's current condition. He says in verse 6, although affliction cometh not forth out of the dust, neither doth trouble spring out of the ground, well, yet man is born unto trouble, as the sparks fly upward. Yes. In other words, men are inherently bad. And Job, you may seem like you're a good guy, but you're not immune from all the temptations of life. So there must be something that got to you that we don't know about. That's what he's saying. That's what he's saying. Paul says there are none righteous, no, not one, by the way, in Romans 3:10. So, Eliphaz is right. Men are born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. You ever watch a fire? You ever had a campfire burning or a fire in the fireplace? And you take that iron poker and you whack the log that's burning real hot and just glowing red, and the sparks, just like that. You got that vision in your head? Imagine each one of those sparks is a sin. Is a sin. And you know what? It's a perfect vision. And just one right after another, just a storm of sin that comes up and encompasses men in their lives, and just one right after another. And boy, are they hot too, are they not, if they land on you. Man's born unto trouble as the sparks fly upward. And just as Eliphaz sees God as the cause of the problem, Eliphaz also sees God as the answer to these same problems. As he sees God as the cause of the problems, he also sees God as the answer to the problems. He says, I would seek unto God, and unto God would I commit my cause. In other words, whatever you've done, Job, get on your knees and pray, confess unto God, and pray that God take it away. Confess unto God and pray that God take it away. God can do that. God can do that, Job. He says, even God which doeth great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number, who giveth rain upon the earth and sendeth waters upon the fields. You know, when I read those verses, I thought about those and how Eliphaz saw those things as great and unsearchable and marvelous and without number. Those things that are rather everyday and mundane. And if you look at the weather forecast for this evening, it's supposed to rain tomorrow. And we just take that for granted. One day it'll rain, next day the sun will shine, the weather changes, and we never think about it. But here, Eliphaz thinks about the rain and the watering of the fields as great and unsearchable and marvelous and without number, the acts of God. Just that one thing. He doesn't live in the age of computers and cars and television and all the things that we have to distract us. Basically, he's got a very simple life, growing food, living life, making sure he doesn't get eaten by a bear. So when he looks out and sees the rain come down, he knows that it's a miraculous act of God. He understands the cycle of things. Things that we don't notice. And I just found that marvelous. And again, in chapter 3 of Romans, as Paul's writing, he writes in verse 11, there's none that understandeth, and there's none that seeketh after God. And not just now, but throughout all of history, most people have had very little understanding of the marvelous things of God. That just rain is not mundane. Rain is not something that just happens. It's a God-given event. It's a God-given blessing. God causes that to happen. He doeth things in unsearchable, marvelous things without number, who giveth rain upon the earth and sendeth water upon the fields. So a truth that's worth pondering, I guess, the next time you have to turn your windshield wipers on. That same God who makes it rain also has power over you and I. To set up verse 11, on high those that be low, that those which mourn may be exalted to safety. He disappointeth the devices of the crafty, so that their hands cannot perform their enterprise. So God can lift those who are in the depths up to the heights, and he can bring those in the heights and spoil the things that they're trying to perform. He taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the froward is carried headlong. They meet with darkness in the daytime. They grope in the noonday as in the night. In other words, he takes their plans and turns them back around on them so that they come to nothing. But verse 15, he saveth the poor from the sword, from their mouth, and from the hand of the mighty. That, my friends, is called justice. That's one thing that God is much in favor of. That's one thing that only the law can do. Again, Paul in chapter 3 of Romans, verse 19. It's an important verse. We know that whatsoever things the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world become guilty before God. Well, Job says in verse 16, so that the poor hath hope, and iniquity stoppeth her mouth. There is a use for law, and that's to stop the guilty, the iniquitous, from doing their deeds. And Eliphaz understood that. He understood the purpose of the rule of law and of the justice of God. The one mistake that he was making, though, was why did God, in fact, use the rule of law and his justice to bring Job down to nothing? Was there a reason why God was punishing Job? And was it secret unrighteousness that no one knew about but God? That was the assumption of Eliphaz. And he's going to continue on with that assumption as we continue in chapter 5. And then next week, and Job will make his reply as we continue on in our study.